But you look at Madison. I mean, Madison could not have been more qualified in the sense that he wrote everything that he was like, every he wrote everything that governed his job. He wrote Article 2. Like,
right.
I made the joke earlier, like, it must be horrible to be the Attorney General for Madison.
Hello and welcome back to The Buck Starts Here, the podcast that digs deep into the juicy stories, power plays, and wild twists that shape the presidencies of the United States. My name's Kyle, I'm your casual history connoisseur, and I'm joined by Eric Mason, our dedicated workaholic civil servant who brings a wealth of knowledge and the wildest historical facts to the table when he's not directing the economy of Quincy. How's that for a better intro?
As an Austrian, I don't like the idea of anybody in the government directing the economy, but tune into the other 9 different things Kyle and I do to hear me ramble about those things.
Nice. No, I just felt like I probably owed you something that makes it sound like you're good at your job rather than shirking your duties whenever I do these intros.
Just straight up insulting my career choices.
All right. Well, last time I think we were able to finish dissecting our 4th president's character. And so today that means we should be taking a look at the policies of James Madison's time in office. So what stands out to you? Like, what are the things that you think we want to touch on today?
Well, I think the biggest, you know, let's say litmus test you can give to any president is how do they change policies from the previous president? You know, in the modern era, in the postmodern era that we've talked about, I mean, it's always fairly radical changes. I mean, there's one thing you can guarantee that happens on Inauguration Day every year, which is a slew of executive orders. And
yeah, we've seen that.
And what's funny is, so Madison was, you know, the 4th person to become president, but he's really the first person to follow a president who was part of his party, right? Because while Washington was a Federalist and John Adams was a Federalist, you really can't compare Washington to any other president in terms of what he meant to the country. He was beyond political parties. And then Thomas Jefferson and Adams, I mean, died friends and they had a certainly intertwined histories, they were very different politically. I mean, could not be different politically. If you could predict whatever Jefferson's position on something was by simply just taking the opposite of whatever Adams' position was. Yeah, so you could tell whatever Jefferson's position was on issue by simply looking at Adams' position and taking the opposite of it.
Right, right.
slavery. Anti-slavery, all right, big, centralized government, anti-slavery.
I thought when we talked about Madison, he actually was conflicted about the whole slavery issue. Like, he actually didn't like doing, or didn't like participating in that, or being a part of that system.
Yeah, he definitely, I like the way you worded that. That's better than what I have in my notes on how I was gonna to word this. So, it is confliction. Is a better now? In my notes I have, I always said acknowledges the hypocrisy. Jefferson never not acknowledged the hypocrisy, but really Madison was the first president to have to follow a president that was part of his party and part of his policies. And you know, well, personally, you know, I think Madison took a much different view on slavery than Jefferson. I mean, it's still owning slaves, right? It's like, you know, still owning slaves. As much as you can be conflicted about something, you're still participating in it.
Yeah.
Now, did he hold the same beliefs Jefferson did on it? No, I mean, at the time, the average American probably thought they were very similar. But as we've, you know, as times pass and clarities become, you know,
how many
more
kids
abundant,
did Madison have?
He never had a kid.
Yeah, okay.
Definitely so didn't have any with somebody he owned, which is a bonkers word to say.
Messed up the way you say that, yeah.
Yeah, he never forced one of his slaves to teach his brother to make mac and cheese for his freedom, which is some Hunger Games. Literally and figuratively some Hunger Games stuff.
Well, you've been saving that one.
I just thought of that now. I'm very proud of myself, Kyle. That's not in my notes. I'll share my notes with you. That's not in my notes. So when we talk about analyzing Madison's decisions as president, I mean, it's really just a continuation of Jefferson's policies mixed in with a very, very, very politically intense. It wasn't necessarily a bloody war. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we did an episode of the War of 1812 where we you know, Kyle and I asked the hard questions to a Canadian on why they burnt down the White House.
We did not get a good answer, by the way.
Yeah, no. All we got told was that Canada was founded later, and yeah, why are you blaming me?
Responsibility. Yeah.
Why that are you blaming me? And I'm why do you keep 30. Yelling at me? It's not, I didn't do it.
Right.
Dodge the questions. Joel, I love you. But no, Madison, so a lot of the stuff that we, all the policies of Madison were simply continuations of Jefferson. And I mean, I personally think some of them are Madison probably disagreed with. I mean,
did he reverse any of them? Like, as we talked about some of the policies that Jefferson did that were not great.
Yeah, there is one particular one, my friend, and I don't know if you were setting me up, if you had, if you knew where I was going to go with this.
No, I do not.
With economic policies. I'd be great if you just had universal knowledge on James Madison. Like, yeah, watch the Nat Geo on James Madison.
Right. So, we're getting close to those people I'm going to start having some knowledge on.
Dude, I wish, I know the rules here are, you're not allowed to like find anything out about the presidents. I would think it'd be funny if you were like 8 biographies on like James Buchanan. And you're like, well, Eric, let me tell you about the worst president. But in particular, the biggest thing that he reversed course on, that was that his mentor, Thomas Jefferson, was not a huge fan of, was the U.S. bank. So the second bank, we call it. So you had the first bank, and its charter expired in 1811. Mm-hmm. It, you know, the purpose of the bank, and if you go back to the Washington episodes, we talked about the establishment of the first bank of the United States, was to basically absorb debt from states, to, you know, basically create a universal currency. I don't really want to get too... They definitely played a huge role in currency, but think of it less of like a mint making a standard currency and more having intergenetic system throughout all states that allowed for that currency to be freely exchanged.
So it's less about having a standardized currency and more about having a standardized exchange. So it's like... Yeah, like in Europe, where you before the euro, like you could trade marks in for francs in France and Germany, and vice versa. Yeah,
but you're all tied to the same dollar, same currency value. And what happened under the First National Bank is that we saw some of this dichotomy, because you had the Northeast that was like super industrialized, like the Industrial Revolution is going on during this time, and then you had the South, which is just like agrarian based economy that. You know, probably wasn't, you know, the cotton gin hadn't really even been invented yet. You know, you really didn't
guys
even...
need some more tobacco?
Dude, that's really what it was. Yeah. The tobacco market got eviscerated towards the end of the 1700s, early 1800s, by, you know, crops being grown in the Caribbean. And actually one of the reasons Madison died poor is because tobacco got grown in Central America, especially we started to see a lot of places like pop up, like Cuba became pretty prominent there, Ecuador, the Hispaniola became really dominated by tobacco farms. And one of the problems you have there is that if you industrialization will always win, like we call that economic intensification, it always wins because people just want stuff cheaper and better. Like they just want cheaper and better.
Just real quick here, I mean, if you were the president at any point in time, you had a chance to shape economic policies. You had a chance to shape, you know, the direction that the country's going. I feel like if you end up going broke because you couldn't create an environment conducive to growing your favorite crop in your own country, you probably didn't do a great job leading the country.
Or you just weren't self-seeking. That's the other option.
I mean, that could be some of that. But
the nihilist Kyle coming out here.
Look, greed is good because greed is usually... greed. In capitalism, our interests usually align, and that's what makes it good. Like, it's good for the individual, it's good for the country as a whole, usually.
I don't disagree with that. I would argue that cronyism isn't good for capitalism.
Yeah, I'd say that's a bit different.
Also, like, slavery just doesn't work from an economic standpoint. I know in this show we discuss this, and we'll probably be discussing it up through Lincoln, but, like, it is a bizarre thing to me. Like, it, generally speaking, you don't look at a really developed economy and see slaves. You just don't. It's not right. Because, like, it's not good to restrict somebody's natural ability to be creative and somebody's natural ability to just define what they best work for. First National Bank under Jefferson was very anti the National Bank, and his protege, Madison, was like, okay, well, I guess I'll let the charter die in 1811. But before Madison left office, he signed it back into law.
Huh. Why did he let it die off then? Like, why?
What?
What was the point of that?
So, I'm going to give you the history answer, like, why it was allowed to die. So, Madison was a Democratic Republican. I always find it funny, by the way. Yeah, I do a lot. We do a lot of research for this show, right? Like, and it brings us down a lot of rabbit holes. Kyle's put up with me, so he gets the royal we.
Appreciate that.
And it does crack me up because as you search through stuff, now we do try and focus on primary sources, but there's always so many primary sources, and there's a lot of great historians who have spent their whole life writing explanations of the primary sources. But one of my favorite things I think I ever read. There's two of my favorite things I ever read. One, we haven't gotten to this episode yet. But it's during the Civil War. I did see somebody get angry when they said it was talking about the paper I was reading was talking about it was explaining why Civil Wars happen, and they were talking about the British Civil War, and I saw a comment on one of them saying, "What are you talking about? English Civil War?"
yeah.
And I'm like, "Which one is seven? What?" But it is very funny because I like to read international sources. There's a lot of stuff that comes here that's from international sources. It's because I think sometimes you get a less biased view. With the early presidents, you don't with the early presidents, but somewhat. George Washington is sometimes seen as this near godlike figure.
Yeah.
All right. Adams gets actually, depending on where you are in the country, or who you're reading from the country, Adams is either like, this is the greatest man, most morally upstanding man ever to be president, or they're like, this guy was a jerk. Like, that's actually very little truth. Right. And then with Jefferson, it's not about where you are in the country, it's when you start reading books, and you can tell exactly when he got the DNA test confirmed that he had slave children.
Right.
The tone of Jefferson very much gets quite almost negative to a point where it's overreaction. It should be a negative reaction, but now it's almost like I don't know how to even word this. It's
you got 200 years of pent up praise that we have to go correct for now.
Yeah, exactly. And it's still a reactive argument. Yes. Well, it should be seen as negative. I mean, I think we've done a pretty good job in the show painting that in a very honest and rightfully negative view. Some of the stuff just becomes almost that's not substantiating the facts. you're clearly speculating. But with some of these international ones, I have found something very funny, which is Madison's referred to as a Republican.
Really?
Because he's a Democratic Republic.
Oh, God. Kid. Okay. Right.
Because it's a Democratic Republic Party. And you'll see a bunch of authors from other parts of the world will refer to him as a Republican. And then you'll get people who will comment on different stuff, and you'll see attempted corrections no, he was a Democrat. And I'm like, no, you're also wrong. Yes, the Democratic Republican Party falls into neither party. That neither one today would fit the Democratic Republican Party. Just like neither party today, as much as there's a lot of Republicans who are members of the Federalist Society, the Republicans today aren't Federalists. Republicans today aren't Whigs. So please, listeners, dear listeners, when we're talking, we're using these terms like Democratic Republicans, there is no modern equivalent to it. You don't see some people like to say Jefferson was the first Democratic president. He wasn't. He absolutely wasn't. He wouldn't have slapped trade embargoes on half the world. what are you talking about? He wouldn't have taken his interpretation of the Constitution. So, no, you can't take modern political party leanings and apply them to this show. Well, hey, we'd stay out
first of
modern
the
politics.
And the parties have changed names so many freaking times over the years. It's I can't keep them straight.
The modern Republican Party, the modern Democratic Party, are never going to be discussed on this show outside of us literally saying, George H.W. was a Republican. Because it's fruitless. So if you do hear us talk about political parties, it's because we're talking about them in the historical context. If you do see somebody refer to James Madison as a Republican, I'll tell you something. Do you know what James Madison referred to himself as?
Federalist?
A Republican.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Well, I mean, he wanted a strong republic. It was a different bit of a different meaning at the time.
Yeah, so it is important when we're talking about stuff like this. We got to take got to take a look at. We can't apply modern lens to this. All right, neither one
that is
was
a good
on
point,
whatever
though. The
TV
only politics we will discuss on this show. The only politics we'll discuss on this show are the ones that are dead already.
Yeah.
That's the only parties we want to talk about.
I'm excited for the Whigs. So back to our boy Madison's economic policies.
Yes.
I was like, oh, is that what we're here for?
Forgot already.
Making fun of Eric.
I thought we were learning economics.
Oh, no, we're going to learn about economics. So in 1811, the first national bank dies. Madison refused to renew its contract. They basically got a 20-year charter when it started, and that was because Alexander Hamilton loved the idea of a national bank. And so the question we have...
Is Hamilton around still at this point, or has he already been...
Him and Aaron Burr already had their meeting in New Jersey with John Church's pistols. It was horrible. It is crazy that Alexander Hamilton, one of the founding fathers, died in a duel with a dude who went on and tried to start a civil war, but East versus West, not North versus South. we ever start a miniseries of just crappy Americans, Aaron Burr is going to be on that list.
East versus West? Whose side was he on?
West. You already get the Western United States to secede from the rest of the country.
Yeah, I don't think he would have won that fight.
No, especially a completely undeveloped area.
12 people to fight that war?
Yeah, right.
12 trappers?
honestly, it might have been good for the country. Yeah, it might have been good for the country. It could have unified us. North versus South, let's put our differences aside, beat up this guy.
Right.
Hamilton is no longer with us at this point. And obviously, Jefferson, one of the reasons Jefferson resigned from being George Washington's Secretary of State is because of Alexander Hamilton's influence and the National Bank. So you can imagine that when Jefferson left office in 1809, he was like, hey, to his literal protege, James Madison, like, we got to kill this National Bank. You're going to have the opportunity to do this. So he let it expire.
Yeah.
And Jefferson really the Democratic Republicans, their platform was pretty much, I don't want to say it was exclusively formed by Jefferson, but it was heavily formed by Jefferson. He was a big influence on it. And they viewed the first bank as unconstitutional and monopolistic. I don't know if I agree with the first part.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was a state-sponsored monopoly, but okay. Monopolies are not inherently bad. Monopolies are bad when the threat of competition does not exist. In some cases, you get more efficient market prices as opposed to an oligopoly.
That's right. I think we talked about it. The threat of competition will actually keep prices suppressed because you don't want to create the environment to allow them to pop up.
Yeah, like if you have a monopoly in a market with very low barriers to entry, mm-hmm. and it's a government monopoly, like the government gives the ability for a firm to monopolize it, to monopolize a market, a lot of times they'll self-regulate and self-cut their prices because it's still better than it was free market. Mm-hmm. But in reality, if that market ever collapsed, it would be an oligopolistic market, which would probably have less than efficient pricing. You don't go from monopoly to free market. There's the oligopoly, which makes up the vast majority of markets, to be honest with you, is in the middle. It's funny that we talk about monopolies and free markets, and I'm always like, that you're talking about the two extremes.
Right.
So Madison lets it die. So
was there like maybe an unwritten promise somewhere in here where Madison like promises to his boy Jefferson, like, yeah, help me get elected and I'll let this thing die. But then all he has to do is let it die and he can re-sign it in. It's now the second one. He kept his promise.
Yeah. So that's a good question. So if we look over at like Madison's role into public life, I don't want to say it might've been even more formal than unwritten. I mean, it was part of the Democratic Republic's platform that mm-hmm. Jefferson wrote. So I think it was more, he ran as a Democratic Republican and he wanted to fulfill the role of his mentor. I mean, Jefferson had a huge impact on his life.
Yeah.
One of the funny things, too, is that Madison was, so we talked about Madison running against James Monroe, right, when he was when they were in Virginia and he beats James Monroe. And everybody's like, whoa, James Monroe is awesome. Like, he's charismatic. Yeah. He's a funny guy. He's very well liked and super intelligent. And he loses. And he's like, wow. And we remember why, right?
Yeah, it's because he just wrote a bunch of letters, like really smart letters.
He wrote a bunch of letters, and he wrote a bunch of letters reassuring Baptists that they would have religious freedom. Yep. And then it's his constitution, which I love. Dude, it must be weird. You wrote the constitution, and then you're running for a position as a rep.
Right.
that's so weird. But Madison was working young at the time. So, like, Madison's, like, well-regarded among the whole country as, like, you know, just a good, solid person. He was very much one of the comments that was popular, I guess, at the time, was he was the most qualified man ever to be president. And best prepared man to ever be president.
Well, that's out of four so far.
Yeah, right. So. Oh, you took a very narrow interpretation of man.
There's been... Oh.
I was thinking of like all people.
I thought you were comparing to his predecessors. All right, fair enough. All right.
Which I take huge, I take huge issue with that statement because John Adams was president at one point before this dude. I'm just going to continuously be a homer this entire series.
I just can't wait to throw back your ratings in your face because I have a feeling that Madison's going to outscore Adams.
Oh, yes, by 30 to 40 folds. And do you know what Adams would say? It doesn't matter what the people like more. It doesn't matter what the people think. Right is right.
Dude, but the problem is you designed this. You helped me create this ranking system. If you're not going to tilt the scales for
even
your favorites, what the
even
hell?
Even I'm wrong?
Exactly. That's how much you love him.
No, exactly. I can be wrong.
Nobody else can love him.
Right. Yeah. Step away, Abby. But yeah, so he was well prepared. I do think it's funny. Like, we talk about people being prepared for presidents. Like, right, we went through a huge portion of the U.S. history where, you know, you had to serve in the military to be president, right? That was really the only way that you become president. Which technically, Madison, I believe, is the first president who didn't command troops. Mm-hmm. But I think if you call what Jefferson did commanding troops,
running away.
You probably have a bust of Jefferson in your house, in every room. Like,
I heard his armpits were sunburned.
Yeah, like. Also, I also apply that to Adams. I don't think Adams ever really commanded troops. Like, oh, he was involved with the Sons of Liberty. I'm like, that's not Washington commanding a general. Right? Like, that's not him being a general. Alexander Hamilton commanded more troops than those dudes.
That's right.
But we went through like a long period of history where you had to serve your country. I do think a lot of people took like Adams and Jefferson serving their country as, you know, them putting themselves, their lives at risk.
There's different forms of service than necessarily have to be militarily. They gave a lot of their lives to this country, I'd say.
Yeah, so I think that was seen as similar to service, right? For better or worse. I think the threat of like death by a foreign power is really what the population wanted. But you look at Madison. I mean, Madison could not have been more qualified in the sense that he wrote everything that he was like. He wrote everything that governed his job. He wrote Article 2.
Right.
I made the joke earlier, like, it must be horrible to be the Attorney General for Madison.
Oh, God, I bet, yeah. Who was his AG?
So he had one of the best-named people of all time.
We got a ways to go for that one.
Caesar Augustus Rodney. Yeah. And then he had William Pinckney.
Wow, he got two Caesars.
William Pinckney, really interesting dude. I think he's one of the guys I told you we should do a side episode on.
And his VP was George Clinton, right?
Yeah.
But, this is a great group of names. Yeah. Parliament Funkadelic and.
I'm a big fan of William Pinckney's just a really, really interesting guy. Really interesting guy. And then the last one also was a great name, was Richard Rush. Dick Rush was his last.
Nice.
This is the last Attorney General. Just Hall of Fame names. I mean, this whole administration's fire. So Madison comes in. He knows all the stuff he's doing. And I know the last, next episode, we're going to get into his actual his day-by-day presidency and stuff like that.
And but ancillary characters, that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah, exactly. So Madison gets in there and... Everybody just accept he's popular. He's widely seen as popular. He rode a pony. He was the last president to ride a horse.
Wait, did you say pony?
It was like a pony. At least that's what the papers at the time said.
Because he was a small guy, right? Wasn't he pretty slight?
The paper said a little man on a little horse. Yeah. It was like one of those things on the paper. Again, I just want to throw it out. Madison wasn't like that crazy short for his time. I don't know why we like... he was popular nationally.
How did he do on his second election, the second term? Because the first one was pretty tight. Was he a lot less close, I guess?
His first presidential election, I don't think it was that tight. His first congressional election.
It was a surprise, though, that he got elected.
Wicked close. You tricked me on here, Kyle. See, I was ready to talk about the first national bank, the I'm scrolling through my notes right now. I prepare. So he won his first presidential election with 65% of the vote, 65-31. So
it was a surprise, but it was also a landslide.
Yeah, I mean, it was.
Okay.
His first congressional election against Monroe was like insane. He only won by, I think, like a tenth of a percent, and it was like literally blew people's minds.
Right.
No, but James Madison, very, very funny, is that how close is he with Jefferson? Jefferson's last VP was George Clinton, and Madison kept him as his VP.
Right.
Like, when have you ever heard that, like, ever happening? I'm trying to think. Who was the last? Harry Truman was a Democrat, right? No, but Harry Truman was FDR's VP. When was the last time we went party? Without the previous guy getting assassinated and his VP become, or dying in office and his VP becoming the next guy.
There's gonna be a lot of dead air while we try to think this one up.
Oh my god, this is actually okay. So
Reagan, has that ever happened?
Nixon? No, because Nixon stepped down, so Ford was the VP.
Yeah.
All right, then we go to LBJ. No, because LBJ became president after Nixon was assassinated, and then LBJ lost to. Oh, sorry, after JFK was assassinated, LBJ became president. All right, so who was before Nixon? Who was for JFK? Was Eisenhower? Eisenhower beat, Harry Truman, who was a Democrat, stepped down. So it wasn't that. Truman was FDR's VP when he died. So that's not there. It would have had to be between Coolidge and Hoover. Wow, dude, it's been 100 years since we've had that situation. That is crazy.
Since we've had a VP take on two different terms.
No, I just meant like even that could have even happened.
Just the fact that, wow.
Yeah. So this is the only time that did happen where you shared a VP between two different presidents of the ever. But even, think of it, that's how rare this even occurred.
Sounds like they basically thought they were just electing Jefferson Part 2.
Jefferson Part 2, like shorter and probably a lot smarter.
Smarter and less hypocritical.
Definitely less hypocritical. I actually, in terms of talking about episodes with people with great names, one of my other great, and I did not put like a little side note to be like, hey, point out any great names. The vice president who lost, Madison ran against Charles Pinckney. Mm-hmm. He loses to Charles Pinckney. Charles Pinckney was, his running mate was a guy named Rufus King.
Rufus
King. If that's not, and Rufus King looks exactly like you think Rufus King would look.
I don't think that's possible.
In this, his fame, we already talked about this dude, but this was a very famous painting by Gilbert Stuart.
Yeah, that's not how I saw.
But his second election was, we would not call it a close election.
Yeah.
But for the time, it was a very close election. So he actually ran against another Democratic Republican who was running as a Federalist, which is bizarre. He won that 50.3% to 47.6%.
That'd be a landslide in today's.
Yeah, not that we ever get too modern, but
right.
We just had that.
All right, so second term, second national bank has started, or he lets the first one lapse. Why does he bring back the second one then? What does he go against the letting it die?
Horrible, horrible, horrible post-war of 1812 inflation. Like crippling destruct. So when the bank closes, I mean, think of a bank closing, right? How damaging that is in general.
Has it paid off all the state's debts yet at this point?
No. So the federal government, this is a good question, Kyle. So the federal government is assuming those payments anyways. They just lost an ability to do it very quick, very easily. They just like added more roadblocks. this is like a super important bank. This is like the Federal Reserve closed. Think of what that does to economies. Now you're a fledgling nation that's 20 years old, or we're older than 20 years, but your constitution's 20 years old. So the War of 1812, which, 1812 to 1815, like it destroys it really messes with the U.S. economy. It exposes all like how weak our banking system is nationally. Like banks aren't going to talk it to each other. And there's no system in place. There's no national bank. There's no First Bank of the United States to manage all this. And then the funny part about it is that what makes the national banks very powerful is that they have the ability, they have the exclusive right, the monopoly on government holdings and government transactions.
Yeah.
Which is a lot of money. A lot of money. And you think of it, like, government expenditures in a lot of cases are 20% of GDP. Imagine holding 20%. Not that you're ever holding 20%, you know, in liquid assets, but a fraction of that.
$4 trillion?
Yeah, just imagine having $4 trillion in cash. Like, that's going to be conducive to efficiencies. And it's not a for-profit bank. Like, you're just using the amazing thing that banking is, arguably the greatest asset we have for economic development is banking outside of education. And you're not making money off of it. There's no, you know, demand of return. There's no Fisher equation to it. Like, of course that's going to help your economy. It's literally insane to think otherwise. It's like when people complain about the Federal Reserve. I'm like, why? Give me a, outside of conspiracy theories, tell me why the Federal Reserve is bad. It's like, I want to still own gold. That's not an economic reason to get rid of the Federal Reserve.
Yeah. Also, there's a reason we got off the gold standard. Maybe that'd be another good short one here to cover one of these days.
Okay, so the bank dies, right?
Yeah.
And the Democratic Republicans have, like, you know, they control the vast majority of politics in the United States. So how'd it come back around?
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is the most fascinating aspect of Madison's presidency. So War of 1812, as it's ongoing. Now, after 1814, the War of 1812 really starts cooling down. I mean, you're seeing negotiations begin to occur. You're seeing a cooling of hostilities. You're seeing less involvement of Native tribes in the West.
Less
capital spending, only two. Okay. It is wild to think if you had to name a war with both nations' capitals got burnt down, I doubt most people would be like, oh, the War of 1812, because that's always seen as like a less intense war.
Right.
That's a good random fact. So it was 1814. As the war is starting to subside and we're starting to see more return to normalcy. Fun fact, the word normalcy did not exist at this point. That was invented by Warren G. Harding, I believe, invented the word normalcy to describe his political platform. So 1814 comes around, and, you know, the war's cooled down, things are back to normal. All these state banks that helped sponsor the war, but whose also their economies were destroyed, so they're not having their normal cash flow. Obviously, think of it, you know, if war is development in reverse, right? Like, think of it, like, these guys came out here, and all those loans were, a lot of those places were destroyed, all those people, you know, weren't able to keep up with their payments. So you see these massive defaults. So the state banks start suspending specie payments. Now, what that basically means is they were refusing to redeem banknotes for gold and silver. Basically forced a fiat currency.
Yeah, yeah.
And all I'm saying is, I don't know what Abigail Adams was doing at this point, but if I know Abigail Adams, she was buying these up.
Oh, yeah.
She was buying these up.
Yeah, she was.
She was having fun with this. Like, she's still in her prime right now. Like, she's specking. Poor John Adams probably sitting home walking. John Adams very famously said that, like, you know, he still loved, he didn't get involved in politics after he was elected. I mean, after he retired from being president, or lost the election for being president. He said, like, I will hold court in government with the people who've always liked me, which are the animals on my farm. So he's probably out there talking to a donkey or something like that. And, you know, you probably get day trading Abby with a little green hat on, right? Green visor on.
Calling
her boys down in Maryland trying to get some of that species. They're giving you 60 cents on the dollar for it. she's the best first lady. It's not even close.
Are we going to talk about Dolly Madison at any point in this? Probably in the next episode?
The next episode, I want to. I brought up the Paul Jennings thing about how she did not run back into the White House to rescue the painting of George Washington. Jennings did. No, she didn't.
Oh, okay.
Also, fun fact, Dolly Madison's name is spelled with an E.
Dolley, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Didn't know that. Found that out while researching this. Could tell you a bunch of stuff about Dolly before I started this, and apparently not how to spell her name, which is embarrassing.
Awesome.
All right. So. Because state banks aren't taking specie anymore, it causes inflation and it causes currency instability. Actually, probably as a lot of our listeners know, but I know this is actually a topic Kyle and I talk about a lot, both together on shows and in our obscene text messages. When you have inflation and inflation drives instability in your currency, you get more inflation because it creates an increased liquidity risk because when you have like specie, like your economy is gold and silver based, when it becomes more risky to turn that piece of paper and get gold, like there's a chance you could give that piece of paper and it, you're not going to see an exchange.
It causes a rush for everybody to go try and pull it out immediately.
Yep. You see inflation on inflation on inflation on inflation. And what you need, and I mean this kind of as a joke, but I don't really mean this as a joke. I mean this as like from like a cleometrical standpoint. Honestly, people like if Abigail Adams like was doing what she did during the revolution and were like speculating on this, that's really good for the economy.
Yeah, you need liquidity. You need people to provide that liquidity. I actually was thinking about the Musk is out there right now like on a crusade against short sellers, right? But short sellers are actually a very vital piece of the puzzle. Like if you want to sell a stock and it's skyrocketing up, who's going to sell it to you? Nobody else wants to sell it. You need somebody there to willing to take on that risk.
Yeah, and that's why in economics, especially like, you know, this type of school of economics I'm in, which is, you know, I always say like, oh, I'm an Austrian who likes econometrics, right? Like, mm-hmm. I like the idea of people making their own decisions. One of the most inefficient things you can do is prevent people from engaging in what they view as their optimized risk level. Mm. And there are people who like risk. Like, that's just the reality of it. Like, Abigail Adams liked risk. Like, there's no getting around. Her investment strategies were not super risky. They were diversified. But the stuff with Abigail Adams, as we covered in the show we did on her, is that she actually enjoyed higher risk assets.
I think it was all shrewd. I think it was very calculated. I don't know that it was necessarily risk. I think the risk was in backing a country in a war against England. I think, like we said in the previous ones, I think that her bet was just, if we're going to win, then I'm going to be set up for the rest of my life. If we lose, then I don't really have to worry about this anyway.
See, I feel like that's super risky.
I don't see how that's a risk at all. How is that a risk?
Well, because like you're not buying like pound sterling or something like that.
Your
like,
life's already going to be right. Right. He's right.
Like, half,
well, I mean,
if half her portfolio was pound sterlings and then half of her portfolio was, you know, continental currency, continental assets, I'd be like, oh, that's somebody trying to basically neutral outcome investor. I'm going to accept that I have half my money afterwards. Oh, dude, I think, like, lending money to people will, like, they're occupied by the Brits, like, before Knox. I think it's kind of risky.
It's super risky, but I think the payoff of it was, I think it was very well calculated. I think she recognized that if they lost that war, that money wasn't going to matter.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree with that. I do think that some of the most intelligent people also are risk seekers, too. I think that you can be both an intelligent investor, but also engage in like risky investments that, you know, somebody like me wouldn't. So as this currency weakens, but there was specifically between 1814 and 1816, it was free fall. It was one of the worst recessions that I would argue it's the worst recession the U.S. had seen since its inception.
Mm-hmm.
I'm arguing that as an economist, not a historian. I'm sure there are much smarter historians than I am as an economist, who would argue it was probably some of the recessions seen in the 1790s, but or the post-embargo act recessions.
Yeah.
The reason I say it was worse is because of a metric we probably don't have that good of a sense on, but consumer confidence.
In the
mid-1790s recession, in the late 1800s recession, you had a national bank. You had an entity that could assist, that could, you know, be used to help recover the economy.
Right.
In 1814, you're in a crashing plane without a parachute. I mean, what does that do to somebody? Like, what does that do to investment, right?
Yeah.
So
we let this thing expire, but we had no fallback plan.
No, everybody thought this is going to be more freedom. There's going to be no bank. It's like, okay, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But
is everybody anti-bank because of what Benjamin Franklin said about him?
I think they were anti-bank because they viewed like, oh, the government has money, then the government can take money from us. No, it doesn't make sense. It's like you have currency, right? Like you have that's issued by the government.
Yeah.
like the government can have money. It can just print its own money. That's one of the things government gets to do.
Right.
Monopoly on violence, it prints its own money. But it's a private corporation. It was the second bank was just like the First National Bank, which is a private corporation. The federal government owned 20% of its stock. It had an exclusive right to government deposits and regulate currency by controlling state bank lending practices. And it had branches throughout the country. It couldn't just have like one bank.
Were there any changes between the first iteration and the second iteration, or is it just basically a cut and paste and stick it back in there and get it back as quickly as possible?
Yeah, it was that one. It was. Okay. There was no real material changes. You will actually see some people argue that there was these huge changes and stuff. Not huge changes. Oh, they're really different. And then when you read the explanations, you're like, no normal person would say these things are materially different.
Instead of first, it says Second National Bank.
Yeah, like literally, I saw like a listicle that I think I read two on because I was like, I'm not getting any of my information from listicles. And literally the first one was equivalent, like, oh, they changed its name. And I'm like, all right, so not reading anything this person's ever written again. How do I block this person from ever communicating with me?
I'm glad I'm not the only one that does that when I read a article. Your website will never show up in my feed again.
Right. But the Second National Bank did some really cool stuff. So it wasn't that their power changed. It was their use changed a lot. Mm-hmm. And the Second National Bank, it was actually tasked with providing a uniform currency, which, as you can imagine, if you come back into existence because currency, you know, kind of went to heck, providing uniform national currency is obviously going to be a big one. They also started regulating state banks. This was really controversial, by the way. Really, really controversial. They started regulating state banks, and obviously we'll talk about this under Jackson, why this ended the second national bank. And this is really cool. So they went into all the states, and they controlled all how those state banks issue banknotes by demanding the state banks redeem their notes only in gold and silver. So they basically said,
So if they ever wanted to cash in their notes, they had to go back to the U.S. bank and turn them in to exchange them.
Huh. Yeah, we start seeing kind of the first regulated fractional banking.
Is this what sets the stage for them to be able to loan out more than their total assets?
Yeah, so this sets the stage for fractional banking.
Gotcha.
Second National Bank, it handles all government finances, and it actually was the entity that would collect the federal tax revenue. It paid government expenses, and it finally got its hands on managing public debt. It did provide credits for individuals. It functioned like a private bank. Something that people get a little confused on, it's not a Federal Reserve.
Okay.
It's not really a Federal Reserve. It kind of is, kind of isn't. It's not what we think of the Federal Reserve today, where the Federal Reserve, really what the Federal Reserve does is use Federal Open Market Committee and actions, to regulate inflation. I don't want to say control inflation because you can't control inflation. Government spending is one of the big reasons you control inflation. The Federal Reserve doesn't have a say in that.
Yeah.
Now, did the national bank set interest rates? By proxy, it did, because it loaned money out. So obviously, the money you get from the federal bank, from the second national bank, is going to be a pretty good idea of the risk-free rate.
Especially when you're talking about the thing that has, 20% of the national GDP available.
Yeah, right. Plus whatever private contributions thrown in there. And the last thing is that it was viewed as a way to balance out the economy during ups and downs, because it could do that by expanding or contracting credit.
Mm-hmm.
So this is cool, because this is before we start to have, throughout the 1800s, you're going to see economics really evolve into this kind of monetary policy. We're still 130, 120 years away from macroeconomics as we know it. But you start seeing this idea of can economies grow? Actually, just the concept of economic growth was getting developed, not around this time, it'd be a little later on, but kind of those early seeds of it were. But wait, is there a way government can react to things and that's going to help the economy? Right. And we start seeing that in the Second National Bank, which gets signed into law to actually not that much fanfare on April 10th, 1816. And it immediately goes to work. You know, by January 7th, about 8 months later, 1817, it.
When did this expire?
Expired in 1811.
1811. So before the war.
Yeah.
Ooh, that was not good timing.
Probably the worst timing. And it, so by 1817, it's up and operating like the National Bank was before. Yeah. We don't really. It's a little weird here. So it doesn't really begin to stabilize until like the mid 1820s. Mm-hmm. And we see that, yes, it, in 1818, it ends up like doing this rapidly, like this, you know, kind of rapid expansion. That's the word, like, I want to use expansion. Its activity increases a ton, but it overissues loans. And then you have all this like speculation driven economic issues. And then, so then you have the panic of 1819, and people are like, dude, we just got you here not to have an economic panic.
Right.
because the bank was just like, oh, whoops, we did that too much. And it contracted all this cheap credit that had flooded the market. Interest rates go up. And this is so cool to me because it's like.
It's like you're watching people like trial and error their way through it almost.
Right? Yeah. You're watching people like, we know how that works today, right? Like, yeah. We know 200 years later how this works. Like, how'd you not see that? But you have some guy be like, why don't we just lend credit to everybody? Everybody can do what they want. It's like, whoa, hold on a minute. Hold on. And this actually goes up to the Supreme Court. So yeah. Kind of the closing action on this is that in 1819, so we'll talk, this will be under Monroe, you have McCulloch versus Maryland. And it's decided, it's decided by the U.S. Supreme Court, led by Justice John Marshall. So it's the guy who keeps recurring. And it upholds the constitutionality of the Second Bank. Congress has implied powers under Necessary and Power Clause to create a national bank. And states cannot tax federal institutions because Maryland tried to respond by taxing the bank. And we'll get into the bank war under Jackson and all that stuff. Yeah. But no, that's, yeah, it's just.
Wasn't that about the biggest... McCulloch versus Madison, did you say? Or?
Yeah, like, versus Maryland.
Versus Maryland, okay. I should make sure I make a note of that because I feel like we're going to need to talk about that a little bit more in depth. But I think that's probably a good place to put a pin in it. Anyway, yeah, join us next week. We start diving into the other notable events that define Madison's presidency. But in the meantime, we want to hear from you. What do you think of the effectiveness of his term? Was he a low-key unifier of the country? Email us at chinashopproductions@gmail.com or visit the website buckstartsherepodcast.com to stay up to date. We'll see you all next week.